We'd like to welcome our own Dean Trainer and Professor Michael Paulson, who flew here from the Twin Cities to be with us today and speak about the unbearable wrongness of Roe v. Wade, on the constitutionality or lack thereof of the 73 decision. Dean Trainer will actually be introducing Professor Paulson. The two of them were law school classmates, and two of them are both very widely acclaimed constitutional law scholars. So we're very grateful for them being with us here to discuss these critical issues at Fordham. I'd also like to acknowledge a generous grant by the John Templeton Foundation. As part of their Templeton series on religious liberties, they've provided our very abundant buffet lunch here. So without further ado, I give you to our Dean, William Trainer.
Thanks very much, Monica. And it's a pleasure to get to do this introduction and to welcome you. I think I've known Professor Paulson for, I hate to say this, a quarter century. And it's frankly upsetting for me to see him here today because he looks the same as he did 25 years ago.
So does he.
Actually, that's sadly true. this is obviously, he'll be talking about what I think is really the most controversial issue of modern constitutional law, Roe versus Wade. And you're very privileged to have a scholar of the eminence of Mike Paulson here today. He's somebody who is I think, one of the leading constitutional law scholars of our time, and who's really both quite brilliant and incredibly insightful, and really approaches each question by kind of going to the roots and asking the most difficult questions that the issue turns on. So he's also very funny. So from every level, he's an extraordinary scholar and he's an extraordinary speaker. And so I'm delighted that he's here at Fordham. I'm delighted to see him again. So as deans do, I'm triple booked this hour, so I can't stay to hear him talk. But you're really, I have to tell you, you are in for a treat. So, Professor Paulson.
Okay, I'm going to set some. Thank you, Bill. Bill and I transferred to Yale Law School together the same year. And so I'm probably one of the few people here. I don't know if it's consistent with the dean persona. I've been drinking seriously with Bill Trainer. So I knew him when he was just a kid, before he was someone serious. And it's good to be here. I really am disappointed that he's too afraid to debate me on these issues. He's smoking a lot of these things. But sometimes it's hard to generate debates on really controversial issues like this. And so I'm going to give it sort of like a stump speech. I've prepared a handout, sort of like a teaching speech. And I think the class is starting at 1:30 or not till 2?
2.
Not till 2? Okay. We will have plenty of time for questions and answers back and forth, and I hope we can generate some of the debate right here. So I'm off to do another good deed, raise some money, keep the school going. It's good to be back at Fordham. I interviewed here for a law professor job, and they actually made me an offer. So it's just the fortuity that I decided to turn it down and go to the University of Minnesota, where I taught for my first 16 years before going to St. Thomas. Minnesota, Wisconsin, here at home. My second religion is devotion to the Green Bay Packers. And I just couldn't quite make this complete switch to New York City. It's always great to come here and visit, though. And I think after this, some of you will actually be glad that I didn't come here, because you would have had me as a constitutional law professor. The title of my talk is a somewhat incendiary title, The Unbearable Wrongness of Roe versus Wade. It's designed to try to taunt liberal opponents into actually debating this. But actually, it's a very grimly serious topic. And what I'm going to sketch out in the next 25 minutes or so, unless I ramble longer than that, is just how extreme Roe versus Wade is as a decision. How its position on the abortion issue really is way at one end of the legal spectrum and political spectrum in terms of plausibility, you know, just by sketching out the bare holding of the case. And then talk about how legally indefensible it is. Roe versus Wade is sort of like the paradigm case of everything that is possibly wrong about constitutional interpretation. This will be your mini con law bar review course, or hopefully a little bit of an antidote to some of the things that Professor Flaherty and others may have taught you here. And then I'll go on to even more grimly serious points about how the legal invalidity of Roe dovetails with its obviously extremely morally troubling, problematic nature, and finally conclude by asking some pointed questions about what you do with a flagrantly illegal, immoral Supreme Court decision that nonetheless continues to command substantial societal consensus. What do you do in that sort of situation, which I think is, you know, the paradigm problem of constitutional law for our age? Well, I'm going to start with Roe's radicalism. I'm going to start with just a bare description of the state of abortion law today, because I think very few people, very few law students, and certainly not very many people in the general public, appreciate just what the holding and holdings of Roe versus Wade are and how they really do go to one extreme end of the perspective. The basic holding of Roe, of course, is familiar to you. It is that there is a substantive individual liberty, an individual right to obtain or commit an abortion of a human life, of a human embryo. Abortion is, Roe versus Wade protects the right to terminate the life of a human embryo or abortion. I think it's important to be clear about that. About exactly what abortion is in the first place. You know, it's not good lunchtime conversation, and we tend to gloss over it, but abortion ends the life of a living human embryo or fetus. It ends a life. I mean, it would not be the procedure it is, and people would not seek it for the reason that they do if it were not the case that it killed something, that ended something. What it kills is a life. There's no doubt that the human embryo or fetus gestating in the mother's womb is a living being. And there's no doubt that the living being that it is of the species Homo sapiens. I think that, you know, just in framing the issue and describing the holding of Roe versus Wade, it's important to recognize that what Roe creates is a right to kill certain living human beings. Now, to be sure, this is human life at a very early stage of development. To be sure, this life may end for other reasons unrelated to intentional acts of violence inflicted upon it. But it's still the case that it is human life, and that the procedure of abortion that's constitutionally protected in Roe versus Wade is a right to end a human life in its embryonic stage. The next point I'd like to make is just how far Roe is to one end of it. Now, when you're taught Roe versus Wade in constitutional law, you're probably given this familiar trimester framework that during the first 3 months of pregnancy, the right to abortion is plenary. During the middle trimester, months 4 through 6, the abortion procedure may be regulated in the interest of protecting the health of the mother. And in the last 3 months, that abortion may be restricted to protect the life of the fetus. And the state has a legitimate or compelling interest in protecting the life of the fetus, but with a huge exception that the mother's interest in health or life trumps. What this produces in practical effect, and what is less frequently discussed in the con law classes, is that as a practical matter, it does provide a right to abortion for essentially any reason, not just for the first 3 months, but for the first 9 months of pregnancy, in the entire period of the pregnancy, there's a constitutional right to abortion. The way this works is this. In the first 3 months, the court is explicit that the right to abortion is plenary. It may be had for any reason or essentially no reason at all. Okay, complete freedom of choice of the mother to terminate the life of the human embryo. During the second 3 months, the only interests that Roe recognizes are legitimate are interests in protecting the health of the mother. Okay, but the government may regulate how abortion procedures are done to make sure that they do not injure the aborting woman, but not in order in any way to protect the aborted fetus. So that really, as long as the mother's interests are protected, she may kill the child during that second 3 months also. So you're up to 6 months. During the last 3 months, the Roe decision recognized that at the point of viability, the state's interest might become sufficiently compelling to justify protection of the interests of the child, but with this exception, and the problem is the exception swallows the rule, okay? That the state may not restrict the availability of abortion, even in those last 3 months where abortion might be needed to protect the life or health of the mother. The term health does not correspond to ordinary common human usage of the term health, but it's really a stylized term of art that's defined in the companion case of Doe versus Bolton, which involves certain regulations of abortion. And in Doe versus Bolton, they define health, and this is paralleled in Roe versus Wade. They define health as any medical, psychological, emotional, family, or economic interest that the woman and the aborting physician agree about. Now think about that. You know, that's a loophole big enough to drive a truck through. If that is your understanding of health, that it can be any economic, social, cultural, emotional reason, and it really can be the case that I do not wish to have this baby, even though it's proceeded to the 7th, 8th, or 9th month, is a sufficient reason under the constitutional analysis of Roe to permit a complete right to choose the mother. So the idea that Roe is cast in terms that make it sound sort of moderate and pragmatic and balanced, but in practical effect, what it produces is a right to abortion essentially for any reason that the mother and the physician agree is sufficient to all 9 months of pregnancy up to and including the point of birth, as the partial birth abortion cases illustrate. There have been some subsequent decisions in abortion law since Roe versus Wade, but none of them really meaningfully cuts back on that radical scope of the abortion right. Planned Parenthood versus Casey makes some slight tinkerings with the standard, with the trigger for when this right to abortion occurs. It's not burden your right to abortion until the state's law has a substantial burden, or poses some sort of undue burden on your decision to have an abortion. But once it's there, the right to have an abortion is still essentially unrestricted. The partial birth abortion cases, first one in 2000, extend this really to a right to a particular mode of abortion procedure at the point of birth. Now, I won't describe it here because I do see people. But the recent decision of the Supreme Court in 2006 upholding the federal partial birth abortion ban is not a meaningful restriction on the right to abortion in any way. Essentially, the Gonzales versus Carhart decision says we can uphold this federal ban on partial birth abortion as a method because there would always be another way to have an abortion. Really, that is the rationale of the decision. This does not burden abortion rights because there's always another available alternative way to kill the fetus. Therefore, we can prohibit the killing of the fetus in this particularly gruesome method. The long and short of it is that current abortion law, just like Roe v. Wade, establishes essentially an absolute right to abortion of a living human fetus through all 9 months of pregnancy, up to and including the point of birth, for essentially any reason that the mother chooses. Sometimes when I teach this in con law, I pose hypothetical questions, and I pose the hard ones, right? under the reasoning of Roe and Casey, could a woman seek to have an abortion in the ninth month for reasons of sex selection of a child? If you take seriously the idea of family reasons or the emotional reasons of permitting that, the answer has to be yes. Okay. Could a woman in the eighth month or the ninth month decide to have an abortion because she has just broken up with the father or the husband? The answer appears to be yes. Okay. The right to abortion under current abortion law is plenary. Now, where does this come from in the U.S. Constitution? This brings me to the second point about Roe's untenability. Okay. Perhaps more than any other canonical case in constitutional law, Roe versus Wade has probably the least strong claim to legal defensibility of anything that you've ever read in common law. There's no plausible argument from the text. Nothing in the text of the Constitution supports the right to abortion. Nothing in the structure or logic of the Constitution, the relationship of provisions, the structures of federalism and separation of powers, of individual rights, supports a right to abortion. Nothing in any decision in history that you can trace to an authoritative act of the people supports the right to decision. There's literally nothing in the Constitution that supports it. I'd like to briefly go through, it's a good review of con law, the various arguments that have been advanced for it. The one that Roe makes itself comes from the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. Now, if you've actually read the Constitution, it looks like the Federalist Society has offered you a few copies in case you never got this in constitutional law. The Constitution, the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, that says no state shall deny to any person the equal protection of the laws or the due or deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Life, liberty, or property without due process of law. You've all probably read at some point these substantive due process cases. The cases of the Supreme Court that have read into the Due Process Clause substantive individual liberties. The problem is that, obviously, the word substantive due process is an oxymoron. It's sort of like, I think, John Hart Ely, the former dean at Stanford Law School, referred to that as saying, that's sort of like saying green pastel redness, you know, substantive process really is textually just sort of gibberish. Okay. The meaning of the Due Process Clause, that individuals may not be deprived of their life, liberty, or property without due process of law, is it is a requirement of legal regularity. Government cannot chop off your head, throw you in prison, or seize your property, except in pursuance to enacted law, a legally valid process. They can't just arbitrarily take things from you in an irregular, extra-legal, procedurally defective manner. The Due Process Clause is all about process of law. The idea of substantive due process takes this idea and sort of reads the words without due process of law out of the Due Process Clause. That's like Hamlet without the prince. It's pure textual gibberish, but there have been numerous cases in our nation's history that have embraced this theory. The leading one is Dred Scott versus Sanford. I don't know, it's not in most of the con law casebooks, but Dred Scott is the infamous case in which the Supreme Court found a substantive due process right to own slaves, protected as against federal regulation in the territory. It's the case that helped to catalyze the nation's conflict that led to the Civil War by declaring the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional. Chief Justice Taney's horrible opinion for the Supreme Court found that the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional because federal laws could not prohibit slavery in the federal territory because it would deprive people of their property without due process of law because there is a substantive right under the Due Process of Law clause. utterly implausible as a textual matter, yet really, intellectually, Dred Scott is the grandfather of the Roe versus Wade decision. He who defends Roe versus Wade on its own terms is defending the legal reasoning of the Dred Scott decision. They are essentially indistinguishable in the substantive due process theory. Now, the ones that do make the casebook are Lochner versus New York, these sort of eras in which they found a substantive right of contract as against government regulation in the latter part of the 19th century and early part of the 20th century. And those cases are also widely discredited. The idea of substantive due process gets revived a little bit in a series of cases in the 60s and early 70s. You might have had Griswold versus Connecticut and Eisenstadt versus Baird, sort of embracing the sort of privacy rationale. The problem with the privacy rationale, in addition to it not really being supported by the text of the Constitution, is that as to abortion, it begs the whole question. Is it really a privacy right to do as you please as long as it doesn't injure another? When there's a very plausible case that this creates an injury to other persons. Even if you embrace generally an idea that there should be privacy rights protected in the Constitution, it doesn't get you to a privacy right to abortion, because you have to get over the hurdle that that there is a separate life in being that is at stake. But even if the precedents actually did support the extension of abortion rights, I put to you a hard question of constitutional theory. If the Constitution says one thing, and the judicial precedents say another, which one do you owe your loyalty to? Which one controls, the Constitution or the faithless departure from it? I often use this hypothetical in my classes. I talk about the Sedition Act of 2009. I suppose the government makes it a crime to speak out against the government of the United States and makes it a crime punishable by death. You get no jury trial, immediate execution by fire squad. The president is directed to carry it out. And your conviction works a corruption of blood and forfeiture of the assets of the next four lineal generations of descendants. As unconstitutional as it can be, if the Supreme Court were inexplicably to uphold a blatantly unconstitutional law, in the case of United States versus Paulson, would that decision really command the respect of future precedents, future courts? And would it really be binding as against other actors in the political system? I think the answer has got to be no, that if the Constitution says one thing and a judicial decision says the other, you have to go with the Constitution every time. It really is the reasoning of Marbury versus Madison. Marbury's argument is not judicial supremacy, it is constitutional supremacy. The Constitution prevails as against any inconsistent act of a subordinate entity. That's why Constitution trumps a statute, Constitution trumps an illegal act of the president, and the Constitution trumps the departure from the Constitution of the courts. So even if these precedents did, having corrupted the Constitution, suggest a right to abortion, I think it would have been wrong to follow. Now, a quick tour of the alternative theories that are often used to justify Roe versus Wade. Because defenders of the decision, very few of them actually defend the judgment on its own terms. I've seen, I think, no serious academic defend Justice Blackmun's opinion in Roe versus Wade as a sound exposition of the Constitution. Instead, what they try to do is develop alternative rationales for it. One is the Ninth Amendment. I kind of enjoy that. There are no really good Ninth Amendment precedents, but the Ninth Amendment provides that the enumeration in this Constitution, end at 145, I think. The enumeration of this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. The Ninth Amendment, simply put, does not itself confer constitutional rights. It is merely a rule that setting forth certain rights in the Bill of Rights does not preempt others you might have by virtue of some other source of law. It is a rule of non-federal preemption of, for example, state bills of rights. And if you go to the history, that's obviously what they're concerned about at the time, is there a concern that the effect of writing a bill of rights might be to somehow repeal by implication state bills of rights? And the Ninth Amendment is merely a plain statement of that. The next alternative that some people turn to is the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, which says that no state shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. It is a rule that states may not interfere with federal constitutional rights. Now, what exactly are the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States? It could refer to a determinate body of certain rights that are constitute privileges or immunities, or it could be, you know, the favorite of more activist interpreters, that's like completely open-ended, that privileges or immunities are whatever courts decide they are. The problems with that view are many, okay? Once you say that the Privileges or Immunities Clause protects whatever someone decides, there's really no principled limit on whatever is. And you can come up with anything, and you could just as easily come up with a substantive right to own slaves as anyone else. The other, even larger problem with the indeterminacy approach is it's utterly implausible to believe that that is what the framers of the 14th Amendment would have intended. At the time they're writing this, they're writing against the backdrop of the horrors of the Dred Scott decision. The idea that they would draft a constitutional provision that would assign to the Supreme Court the power to create whatever new rights they thought appropriate, not remotely within their conception. In fact, if there is sort of a body that would be charged with defining the privileges or immunities of citizens, it would be Congress. Section 5 of the 14th Amendment provides that Congress shall have the power to enforce the article. But I think instead there's a very basic clear understanding of the Privileges or Immunities Clause that doesn't get you into that problem. And that is that the privileges or immunities of citizens in the United States are the protections of the Bill of Rights and other constitutional provisions and maybe some federal statutory provisions that protect individual civil liberties. States can't abridge federal constitutional and statutory rights. That's really what the 14th Amendment Privileges or Immunities Clause says. I think it's the best basis for what is often termed the incorporation of the Bill of Rights as limitations on the powers of state government. Okay. So again, I think that alternative hypothesis for abortion rights doesn't work either. And the last one, and this is Ruth Bader Ginsburg's favorite, is the Equal Protection Clause. Now, as the cottage industry of trying to develop alternative theories for Roe goes, this is perhaps the most plausible. The argument is that the idea of equal protection of the laws forbids abortion regulations on the theory that they are gender discrimination. Okay, that's basically the theory. You probably see that in your footnotes or the notes in your Gunther Sullivan casebook after Roe versus Wade. The problem with that is that the core idea of equal protection of the laws, may I take this off? I'm getting all worked up. The core idea of equal protection of the laws is that the government may not literally withdraw the protection of the laws from certain classes of citizens. The whole idea was that the newly freed slave class, the freed blacks, were entitled to the protection of the laws. Southern governments could not just turn them over to the private violence of the Ku Klux Klan, look the other way, and deny them the full protection of the laws. I think that's the literal and original meaning of equal protection. And actually, that has a boomerang effect in terms of the protection of the lives of unborn human fetuses. But I think there is an aspect of equal protection of the laws that means the substance of the laws cannot discriminate. The substance of the laws cannot discriminate among classes of individuals. And of course, the core case of that is laws that discriminate officially on the basis of race. The subcategory to which I think equal protection clause does reach is laws that discriminate on the basis of gender. Analytically, though, I'm going to get some techie weenie con law professor. Laws that restrict abortion are not laws that classify on the basis of gender. They classify on the basis of certain conduct that men and women can engage in with respect to unborn life. They prohibit certain conduct, and they don't prohibit that conduct merely when it's engaged in by women. It's true that men do not have abortions, but men commit abortions. Deeper than the doctrinal problem is the premise that seems to underlie this idea that equal protection requires abortion rights. The premise that's lurking there seems to be that women cannot be full equal citizens of men unless they have the right to have abortions. I frankly find that condescending, that a woman cannot be the full equal of a man unless vested with a right to kill her unborn child in order to be divested of the inconvenience, economic or social, of having a child. And ironically, it has a feedback loop in that that notion of equal protection is very male-centric. And the effect of it has been, frankly, guys, to divest men of their responsibility with respect to the care and upbringing of children. So I think there's a real problem in terms of what lies beneath this idea that abortion is necessary for equality. Finally, there's a great hypothetical, well, it's not really a hypothetical, that tests your seriousness about the equal protection idea. And this is an idea that I'm proposing. I have a draft article in progress, and I've been working with some people on, in terms of proposing legislation to ban sex selection abortion. How do you feel if you're pro-choice about a ban on sex selection abortion? How do you feel if you're an enthusiastic supporter of equal rights for women about the practice of people aborting children for reasons of selection of the gender? Typically, they select in favor of male babies and against female babies. There's some cultures in the world where that's really predominant, and you can see that statistically that is the preference in America. The logic of Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey would tell you that my proposal is unconstitutional. It restricts the right to choose. And the premise of Roe versus Wade is that the unborn child is legally a nullity, is nothing, so that you really cannot prohibit abortion when had for any reason. If you were to agree that that type of abortion is bad, abortion had for reasons of gender selection of the child, ask yourself, why? What makes it wrong? And it has to be some sense that the child, you know, it's not an it. It's a girl, or it's a boy. Okay. There is a humanity to the fetus. Okay. So the irony of the equal protection argument for abortion is it has been used often to support what is essentially a right to kill babies on the basis of their gender. Now this brings me to the big point. It's like, even if you think that there's presumptive substantive due process, Ninth Amendment, privileges or immunities, equal protection, right to abortion, in constitutional law there's always this trump for a compelling state interest. A compelling state interest can predominate, okay? And here's where I think abortion doctrine totally misses the boat, is it fails to come to grips seriously with the question of what is an abortion. If it is the case that abortion ends a life, and if that life is human, then isn't the protection of that life a compelling interest that would trump just about anything else? In free speech law and equal protection law, there's always a trump for a compelling governmental interest, and the most compelling of governmental interests I could imagine is the protection of innocent life from the private violence or public violence of others. Roe elides that question by saying, we don't know when life begins, but then it essentially treats the interests of the state in protecting human life as not of any consequence whatsoever. Now the last theory on which abortion rights are defended is the one of Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which is kind of the most interesting and peculiar of all. the Supreme Court today does not embrace Roe as being right on substantive due process grounds. Does not embrace Roe as being right on equal protection grounds or on any other grounds. They embrace it as being, well, not even right, but something they will adhere to on stare decisis grounds. Planned Parenthood versus Casey, by vote of 5-4, adheres to Roe because we decided it that way before, and it would be deeply embarrassing for us to go back on a big landmark decision. The court, in the end, is not prepared to reaffirm Roe as right, but reaffirms it merely because that's what we've done before. Well, if we upheld a conviction wrongfully under the Sedition Act of 2009 and executed Professor Paulson, does that mean that in the next case we would have to execute Professor Traynor for committing the same offense? I think stare decisis is the truly mistaken notion that you should deliberately adhere to something that you are fully persuaded is wrong. Now, stare decisis has never been absolute in American constitutional law, and I really do think that the court in Casey was hiding behind stare decisis as a way of avoiding directly confronting a difficult issue. I tell my con law students, usually in the first year when they ask, well, what is the true force of Supreme Court precedents? I think the correct descriptive answer is that Supreme Court always follows its prior precedents, except when it doesn't. I don't think you can persuasively rest abortion rights on the ground that we've done this before, therefore we have to do it again. Now, after exhausting all the legal theories, I have to conclude that Roe versus Wade has no legitimate basis in the text of the Constitution, the structure of the Constitution, the history of the Constitution, or even the most extreme interpretation of some of the precedents of privacy, and is not truly supported by the doctrine of stare decisis. It is just purely made up substantive policy of the Supreme Court that we've had now for 36 years. And this brings me to my point of sort of righteous indignation, the point of Roe's immorality. If you really do believe that the right that Roe creates is a right to terminate a human life, you have to come to grips with the potential stakes that that entails. Okay. Since Roe, there have been approximately 50 million legal abortions in the United States. The Nazi Holocaust killed on the order of 6 million Jews. It is always like, you know, going over the top rhetorically to say this is like a Holocaust, this is like the Nazis, etc. It's in some ways a conversation stopper because it's almost too intolerable to agree to. You can't. Okay. But I put it to you, I wonder. If you hold this view of abortion, but are still sort of moderate about it, are we not a nation of Holocaust deniers? If we deny the true moral effect of the legal decision in Roe versus Wade, are we not a nation of Holocaust deniers when the consequence of an illegal decision like Roe versus Wade is on the order of 50 million deaths? That's 1/6 of what would be the present U.S. population. It's 1/4 of the African-American population. The leading cause of death in the African-American population, the leading cause of death in America is abortion. People often say, well, we are so much more morally enlightened than, say, the Nazi German, you know, German culture. But I wonder, does moral progress always move forward chronologically? I wonder if we are in a situation where we're so close to it that we cannot really appreciate the evil, the horror that is tolerated in our midst. Okay. Now, you don't have those problems if you're able to deny that the unborn human life is human life. The problem is that biologically, medically and scientifically, that's almost an impossible argument to make. Biologically, medically, the new conceived human embryo gestating in the mother's womb is an independent life. It is dependent on the mother for sustenance, but it's an independent life. And biologically, it is human life. I think it's really hard to get around those things. And so most pro-choice defenders are left to the position of not wishing to protect some forms of human life because of their dependency. I submit that that is horribly illiberal to refuse to want to protect the most defenseless persons in our society. Okay, that brings me to my last point. What do you do with a horrible, unlawful, illegal, morally atrocious Supreme Court decision? And here is a kind of one of my central shticks of constitutional law. The Constitution does not establish the Supreme Court as the only authoritative interpreter of the Constitution. The Supreme Court is not alone in the power to interpret the Constitution. It has the power to interpret the Constitution as a function of its power to decide cases. But likewise, the President and the Congress have the power of constitutional interpretation when it involves some of their own duties. If the Supreme Court has decided a case contrary to the Constitution, the other branches of government have an independent duty to seek to check and correct the wrong interpretation of the Supreme Court with all of the constitutional powers at their disposal. James Madison, the patron saint here, that's his mug, not much of a resemblance here, wrote in the Federalist number 49, so the several branches of the government being perfectly coordinate by terms of their common commission, neither of them can pretend to a superior power to decide on the boundaries of the others. I think that the reality of our constitutional system is that, well, the original meaning of it is that each branch has an independent power to interpret the Constitution. Where a Supreme Court decision flagrantly departs from the Constitution, it is entitled to no respect, no deference, and no enforcement by the other branches of government who swear their own oaths to interpret the Constitution. Okay? Now that's a radical challenge to conventional doctrine of Supreme Court supremacy. But it basically says that the ultimate control over the people's constitution must lie with the people, and that they can use their power to check the decisions of the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, a little bit of current events, and compliance with the Templeton grant requirements. We've recently elected a president in the Congress that is not at all committed to protection of the right to life. In fact, I admire Barack Obama in many ways, but he is the most aggressively and extreme pro-abortion president we have ever had. As an Illinois legislature, he opposed laws that would protect children accidentally born alive as a consequence of abortion. He opposed a Born Alive Infants Protection Act, basically saying that where an abortion fails and the child is living, it should be open to the physicians and mothers to assure that the child does not survive. Not even abortion is a right to terminate a pregnancy, but it's a right to a dead baby. In addition, there's now speculation that Obama administration will rescind the Bush administration regulations protecting liberty of conscience of persons not to facilitate abortion or the use of abortifacient medicines like morning after pills and RU486. In addition, the Obama administration is changing the rules in terms of government financial support for abortion. First, in terms of foreign aid to entities that support or provide abortion, and probably coming down the road, abortion being provided and funded in terms of medical care of the United States. Finally, there are proposals to entrench Roe versus Wade by statute in something called the Freedom of Choice Act, which would have the effect of even protecting against a reversal of Roe versus Wade and attempting to establish the same rights by statute. From the perspective of someone who thinks Roe is wrong and that abortion is wrong, this is not a cheery prospect. We are committed as a policy of the nation for right now to the serious promotion of abortion, and we are firmly committed to Roe versus Wade as possible. Now, on that cheery note, let me leave it to questions and comments. So we'll start here, then go there.
I have a moral question, I guess, and a legal one as well. What if, because we don't know for sure scientifically whether it is a human life or not, I see it as kind of like an X and Y axis, where on one side we have a woman's liberty and to do what she wants with her body, and on the other axis we have how close it is to human life. So in essence, the further we move towards it being a human life, the less we're willing to compromise, the more we're willing to compromise a woman's liberty. So I think that you would be hard pressed to say that on the first day it is human life worthy of taking, of completely taking away a woman's liberty. But on month 9, it seems much closer to a human life, to where, of course, we would want to forego the woman's liberty. What do you think, first of all, of that kind of spectrum? And I know that's how Roe was somewhat decided. Maybe the 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, that's not very scientifically accurate. It doesn't seem to exactly describe this situation. But I thought that that was, at least in my view, as someone who is kind of ambivalent about the issue, I mean, I'm not sure how I feel. That seems to me like a logical, moral approach.
A great question. Okay. You know, it's kind of like, is there logically a sort of a continuum in terms of protection of life? Okay. The first point I'd make an appeal to you is that is not at all our current legal regime. Okay? You know, and the fact is, you know, if you have qualms about abortion as it gets closer to birth, you have to have huge qualms about the lines the Supreme Court has drawn, or rather hasn't drawn. It's created an absolute right the whole way. Okay, and then the other tact is, well, how far can you really push it up forward? And you start this, she started the question with, you know, if there is doubt about whether it's life. I actually think there's no doubt as to whether or not it is an independent human life. Now, that doesn't give you the question of, are we going to afford protection to human life, even at its very earliest stages? And I think people would prefer, I think, to have a sliding scale sort of thing, because it seems at some point counterintuitive, counter to our experience, to push it back all the way to the point of conception and implantation, the very earliest stages of pregnancy.
But I mean, you could say, like, every time a woman has her period, she's destroying human life. Or, I mean, it's not voluntary, but you could definitely take medicine that would prevent you from having it as often as you do, and so then you wouldn't be destroying life. Or any time, you know, men have any type of emissions, that's also destroying human life. It's the potential of human life there, right? So where, just because, okay, at that one intersection it met, but still,
well, that's
it could,
the, that's
it could
the
still
key
die.
Difference. That's the key difference. Sperm is not independent human life. How red is my face going to get? eggs and having a period is not the destruction of independent human life. Biologically. Yeah. I mean, this, I learned this in eighth grade, ninth grade, right? This wasn't even second. This is just basic biology is, you know, when I pluck out a nose hair, I'm not killing an independent human life. Okay? A new life form, a new human life, a new human identity, 23 chromosomes plus 23 chromosomes, united to form 46 distinctive, is created at the moment of conception. I think medically there's no way to get around that. Now, I think one of the huge barriers to people accepting that is it seems so small. It seems so, you know, right immediate. You know, and it's just hard to follow the logic of that all the way to its position. I'm a pragmatist. If I could win over your vote to end abortions after the first month, okay, and save literally hundreds of thousands of lives that way, I would do it. I would take what I could. I think logically the stopping point has to go all the way back to wherever there is the creation of new life. Now, as a practical matter, that means that will impose restrictions on individuals' liberty, right? Because, you know, pregnancy, I've never experienced it other than secondhand, both as a father and at one point as a fetus. it restricts liberty. I don't know how many of you are parents, but being a parent restricts liberty.
Okay.
And I think no one should trivialize the burden and the benefit of pregnancy, childbirth, okay? And we absolve too easily males of that. But the law imposes burdens of responsible care for other individuals and people all the time. I cannot abandon my children. My wife cannot abandon her children. Let's go to the second question. I forget where it was.
It was me, but it was actually very similar to what Shelley just asked. So
okay, so let's go way in the back.
Does the burden that you mentioned extend to the point of giving up your own life? If a woman's life is in danger, she's, let's say, 6 months pregnant, and they have to terminate the fetus to save the mother's life, would you say that is acceptable?
Wonderful question. In fact, we were talking about that in the cab back from breakfast. What was it called? My very favorite food place.
Something like that.
It's down near the Hello Deli, which is where I really wanted to go. I think that the state could legitimately provide the scope of legitimate self-defense is really the issue, okay? And I'm not one of those who would say that the mother's life should yield to the child's. Okay? I can see a plausible moral argument. I think you're in the realm of moral reasoning, okay? As you get further and further away from the idea of actual protection of the survival of the life of the mother, when you're in a true tragedy, so, you know, choice of evils, situation, and you're getting to more things like, this would be an inconvenience, this would impair my ability to go to law school, this would, you know, this would be a third child, you know, or this would be a girl. Okay? The notions of self-defense become less and less plausible. Okay? When I teach this in con law, I run down sort of the series of slippery slope hypotheticals. The problem is in our law, the abortion jurisprudence of the Supreme Court right now resolves all these issues totally in one way. I have no doubt that if Roe versus Wade were overruled, every state in the union would protect a self-defense exception to protect the life of the mother, where the continuation of pregnancy actually posed a threat to the life of the mother. And I would not oppose that. Up here.
But if Roe v. Wade were, let's say, to be overturned or ignored, the prerogative to regulate abortion would just fall back to the states. So,
can you hear the question? If Roe were overturned, the prerogative to regulate abortion would go back to the states. Yes.
So, are you of the opinion then that the federal government should then enact a law prohibiting abortion throughout the United States? And are you of the opinion that those states in which, let's say, a woman does an underground abortion with like a wire hanger or something? In that situation, would you prosecute the woman with a premeditated murder one?
I haven't really thought that much about the hypothetical alternative universe in which abortion actually can be prohibited. I do think if you take seriously the idea that this is the killing of an independent human life without justification, that you could appropriately make it subject to homicide law. My view is that, you know, one of the central problems of the abortion jurisprudence is it does not credit the interests of the unborn living human life to live and to be entitled to the protection of the laws. The precise form in which the protection of the laws occurs, I'm not sure. We can sit down and negotiate that and draft a statute that we can all agree on. But I think in principle, that it has to reach potentially the area of criminal penalties. I would not foreclose that. Back.
When it comes to the equal protection argument, is it not true that equal protection amendment was designed to protect against discrimination on the basis of gender, race, and not discrimination or laws that disproportionately affect one gender or race, but are not aimed. For example, if New York City would pass a law, as New York City did, banning trans fat in restaurants, somebody who shows statistically that a particular ethnic group disproportionately ate or bought trans fat, would that fall under the equal protection guidelines? I don't think so, because
let me put aside the trans fat hypothetical. Because your essential point is right. You've learned your con law correctly. Is that most of our equal protection jurisprudence treats really differently laws that classify on the basis of race, or that classify on the basis of sex, as opposed to laws that may have a disparate impact. Okay, this is Washington versus Davis in the race context, and someone can help me on the case. Is it Massachusetts versus Feeney? Okay, good. You don't know either. I can pretend. It's Massachusetts. The law that disproportionate, I think it's some state that provided a veteran's benefit, veteran's preference in hiring, and there were more, at the time, male veterans than female, was that a law that denied equal protection to women? You know, and the court, of course, there's the classic case of Gedulding, which has to do with whether a classification based on pregnancy is a gender classification. You know, that pushes close to the line. But if you're classifying an abortion, you're not classifying on the basis of gender. You're classifying, the reason for the law is the premise that you were trying to protect human life. Okay, you're trying to protect that human life from the violence of whomever may inflict harm upon it. So I think that the equal protection argument kind of relies on a sleight of hand. You know, hey, this is a classification. We're not saying this is a classification based on gender, but look how, you know, if it only affects women. Well, but its regulation is not in terms of classifying on the basis of gender. So way in the back, yes. You, Blue.
All right. I have a question about the paper that you're working on about sex selection.
Yes.
Just wondering if there's, in your research, you've come across information about how frequently that occurs in, I know you mentioned other cultures, but in the United States,
mm-hmm.
If you see it as a practical problem or more as just a moral, ethical checkpoint?
You know, it's both. I've tasked my hapless research assistants to sort of figure out to what extent this is a real situation. It is real enough, okay? I don't wish to engage in racial or gender stereotypes, but in some Asian cultures, in India and in China, the preference for male babies is so extreme, and where there are, you know, population control limitation policy, it has produced disproportionate abortions of girl babies, and it produced substantial population differentials. Some of those populations are then represented in the United States, but even across all races, there is a preference for male babies. Okay? You know, I have a boy, I have a girl, I have two nieces who were adopted from China who were basically rescued from orphanages as a consequence of this. I don't know that it is the most pervasive reason for abortion. I don't know, you know, it's certainly not the leading one, but there's enough out there that it's a real situation. Actually, what you were seeing a lot of my research assistants tell me is as you are getting to in vitro fertilization clinics, you're having parents design the desired characteristics of their babies and they're choosing boys over girls. How much of that translates into abortion, I'm not sure empirically. But you're right. I want to put people to the test of this. Okay? Here is the hard case, Supreme Court. We've passed a law banning abortion for the reason of sex selection. Constitutional or not. Okay? If it's true that you can ban it for reason of sex selection, why? It's because the unborn fetus has human characteristics. You can look and see a penis or not. Okay? You can do tests. You can tell. You know, at one point, just in terms of medical checkups, we were able to ascertain at week 14 or so that my little girl was going to be a girl. And we started picking girl names. Okay? Once you concede human characteristics, human realities to the fetus, it becomes a lot harder to say that you can abort on the basis of that human characteristic. You could abort for race, you could abort for disability, you could abort for sex. And I think, I'll be honest about this, I would intend it as a wedge issue, okay? Supreme Court, would you like to retreat from this? or you're going to take a position so extreme that 90% of Americans will actually say, no, 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 this can't be right. You've completely forfeited your moral authority. You know, we don't believe it. We see it now. We see it. Wow, you can abort a baby because it's a girl. Behind Reuven.
This might lead into your last comment pretty well. Could you talk a little bit about the parallels between Dred Scott and Roe v. Wade and how they define person and how they say that black people in the one case and fetuses in the other are not persons as the Constitution defines them?
Okay. Dred Scott and Roe versus Wade draw the parallel a little more fully. I'm one of the few con law professors who actually gives a full edited version of Dred Scott decision because I think it's one of the most historically and jurisprudentially important decisions in American constitutional history. The two main atrocious holdings of Dred Scott are first that blacks cannot sue for their freedom under diversity jurisdiction because a black cannot be a citizen of the United States, free or slave. And it says that they are despised and disparaged race that is entitled to no rights which the white man is required to observe. Absolutely monstrous. It declassifies a species of the human race into a subclass. Okay? Not quite saying non-humans, but entitled to no rights that the dominant class gives up. Now you can see that some obvious rhetorical parallels with Roe. we are essentially, Roe versus Wade treats a class of the human species as entitled to no rights. No rights which the already born are required to protect. I actually find the stronger parallel in the substantive due process legal holding. Because the second holding is that Congress cannot prohibit slavery in the territories because you have a substantive due process right to own slaves. Okay? And this is the decision that sort of launched substantive due process. If you have a theory that courts can take a provision of the Constitution and read into it whatever content they want, you have to admit that they can then read into it whatever horrible content they want. Dred Scott is Exhibit A in the case against judiciary having the power to just sort of develop rights as they go along, because there's no reason to believe that it won't be a horrible thing to develop. Okay? Sometimes the courts do good things. Sometimes the courts do bad things. I'd rather stick with the Constitution. I count Roe versus Wade as a parallel tragedy. Jurisprudentially, it very much resembles Dred Scott, and I think morally, very much resembles Dred Scott.
Reading here from Roe, it says, we are persuaded that the word person as used in the 14th Amendment does not include the unborn.
Right. Well, you know, actually that's a somewhat distinct question. Is the meaning of the word person within the 14th, you know, does the fetus possess affirmative constitutional rights? I actually think that's a fairly debatable question whether they are persons within the meaning of the Equal Protection Clause that they are constitutionally entitled to. You don't need to get that far in order to uphold legislative decisions to protect them, but I think that's a very interesting point. I'm going to pass you over, Mouvain. You got me at lunch, so.
In your opinion, what is the most likely scenario for abortion to be illegal or Roe v. Wade to be completely overturned?
The most likely scenario?
How do you think it's going to happen?
I don't want to depress those of you who are pro-lifers, but I think the moment came and passed in 1992. And I doubt if Roe v. Wade will be overruled or even significantly limited in my lifetime. Or in your lifetime. Now, I actually think socially, sociologically, and culturally, there are two reasons for that. Is that there's now been 36 years of legal abortion. Many people know or personally have had abortions. Okay? And at some point it becomes very, very difficult to accept. The cognitive dissonance is too high for people to be confronted with the idea that what they may have done was killing a form of human homicide. And I think that our pervasive having been a culture of abortion for so long makes that really, really hard for people to confront. I don't think the society will do that. The other thing is this, and this kind of goes to this woman's question up front, is especially among young elite professional populations, the use of in vitro fertilization techniques as a way of assisted reproductive technology has created a situation of lots of conceived non-implanted embryos. These are people who wish to have babies, and as sort of a collateral consequence, there are many frozen embryos out there. And I think the logic of the pro-life position, if it would also force people to confront the morally problematic nature of that situation, again, cognitive dissonance is just too much to bear. I do have a proposal, and it occurs to me as I was talking about. I published this in an obscure article, okay? Because I am a student of Civil War history in Dred Scott, okay? The Missouri Compromise passed in 1820 doesn't sustain. By 1860, you have Civil War. What if instead of drawing a geographic line about where slavery can extend in 1820, you draw a time? What if you say 40 years? Can we phase this out in 40 years? Okay. What if our nation said, we hereby adopt a constitutional right to life amendment that becomes effective as 2049. So it's not going to affect you. It's not going to affect you. It's not going to affect you. It's like a commitment to not continually pursue this policy. You know, to be directed toward a situation where there's both reproductive freedom in some sense, but not abortion, and we figure out the technological way to do this. I think I've heard the expression, if you give a lawyer a long enough deadline, he'll agree in advance to his own hanging. I think if you defer this decision out sufficiently far on the time horizon that it doesn't assault anybody's present views or conduct, that we might commit to saying that our children should not abort their children. That's the one prospect. Yes, sir.
So then on the contrary, do you think there's ever going to be a point in which this doesn't become a hot button issue anymore? Because of the cognitive dissonance thing, it's going to come to the point where we just don't care about it as much. Too many generations have been post Roe v. Wade, mm-hmm. and it's just a matter of life, of our society and life.
I don't know. I'm not a good futurist. I'm just a simple constitutional lawyer. You know, and no one in 1858 foresaw the end of slavery within 7 years. Okay. Now, I don't want a cataclysmic civil war and 600,000 extra people's death, right? But in my optimistic moments, I think that, you know, just as only Nixon could go to China, okay, maybe only Barack Obama, confronted with the reality of a black genocide, could be the person who would actually say, you know what, you know, I support the right to choose, but we got to figure out a way to not be doing this in the future. Yeah. Maybe. So I don't want to give a total hope, but I don't see it. Way back.
Is it hard taking that idea, you know, let's just set a timeline in the future, especially because we know it didn't work with slavery. They tried to do with, like, this ending the slave trade by saying, well, what was slavery? When they drafted the Constitution, it was like, we'll put off slavery to another time, you know, we're never going to use the word slavery in our Constitution, we're going to end the slave trade in 60 years, and, you know, they tried to keep the status quo of the compromise, and eventually just led to war. So I think people's knowledge of that would make saying, you know, we're going to end it in 100 years, no one's going to agree to it.
Maybe they won't agree to it. I actually disagree with you on the slavery rationale. I think you could have avoided civil war and extinguished slavery if you'd done this. So this is kind of off the Roe versus Wade. They do know how to put sunset provisions in the Constitution. They said you can't restrict slavery till 1808. What if you went further and said slavery shall not exist in the United States? You make your 13th Amendment effective as of 60 years from the adoption of the Constitution. I think that passes. That's a better compromise than a 3/5 compromise. three-fifths compromise operated to perpetuate, extend, entrench slavery, and to provide a vested interest in supporting it for those states that benefited in terms of representation.
And so they gave, like, with the three-fifths compromise, they gave the slave owners, you know, their cake and let them eat it too.
I agree. So it's actually the opposite of what you're saying. I think that the best hope would be to adopt something for the future. I'm told we're out of time. This spares me the question from Ruvane. Do you wish to use some closing words, or just like have a good class?
I just want to say that there's sign-up sheets for all three groups there for the Catholic Students Pro Life and FedSoc. If you're not on the email list yet, you can sign up there. And the New Federalist paper, the FedSoc's paper of their student groups are out. It's a picture of one of our events at page 4, so pick them up there.
Okay.